a 4.5% internal rate of return when you factor in a 30% tax, a 1% fee. And then I just looked at the cost of insurance that the person would have to pay in term over those 30 years.
Right.
And we're looking at a 10.69% every single year. If we could actually compare this apples to apples to a like asset, this is a more accurate number just when we're comparing the rate of return to other like assets.
This is the part that's left out of that conversation. So that weight of those bonds that we have to support the equity side actually makes 12% turn into 8%. And the life insurance policy is outrunning that. And we're not saying that life insurance should be compared to investments. It shouldn't. It's a savings vehicle, right? But it is interesting how closely the return relates to even, you know, what people expect to do elsewhere.
Hey guys, it's Caleb Williams.
First off, debt is a function of your assets.
First question I have is as it relates to internal rate of return. And I've been on a kick lately. People talk about arbitraging. They make it sound like you're making more money in your policy than what you're using it. And that's just, in my humble experience, that's not something that we should be promoting, especially if you're talking about whole life insurance. So I want to talk about internal rate of return and the hard truth there. But then I also want to stretch our brains and say, okay, if we factor in other factors, like the fact that life insurance, when set up and used properly, grows tax deferred and can be used tax free and gets passed on income tax free. And when we look at other things, like it comes with an increasing death benefit, whereas in a different scenario, you would have to pay for that. And you have things like chronic illness riders, and you have other things like privacy and other areas. My question to you is, can we walk through a scenario where we could say that life insurance gets an equivalent to an 8, 9, 10%? And can we say that while also saying you don't get arbitrage when you look at the pure math? So I'm kind of setting you up with a complicated, you know, set, but I really believe like this is when I learned from you probably helped me understand life insurance better than anything else that you talk about. You use the funding calculator to kind of walk through this concept. But for me, it like there's epiphanies that happen and it grew my conviction for a boring old life, whole life insurance because of certainty, but because I ultimately understood internal rate of return and I valued it way greater than whatever the illustration showed me.
Wow. That's a bunch of stuff. And so I'm going to go through and try to, I think where I want to start with is explaining what internal rate of return is and just seeing, so work on this piece. But the cool thing about internal rate of return is it applies opportunity cost automatically. And so what's cool about internal rate of return is you can actually compare two different assets and their growth that even have different cash flows. But the IRR will tell you what the return is based on what you've put in with opportunity associated with it. Okay. And so the way internal rate of return works behind the scenes is the computer actually takes all the cash flows and what the end future value is, and it calculates, okay, what happens if I apply 2% to all that? Oh, nope, it was short on the money out there on the end. Okay, let's apply 3%. Oh, that's more than that. Okay, let's apply 2.5. And it works on that until it finds a number that is level for all those payments, ins and outs, to get to whatever the future value, which might be zero or it might be a large number. And that's the way internal rate of return works. It's always looking for a level amount, not just in the first year or somewhere in between. So even though the earnings across the time frame may have had ups and downs and everything else, the IRR finds out basically what rate level every single year would get you to that end goal with those cash flows. So it really is a levelizer if you can understand that. This is the downside of it. It's hard to understand when we look at it with a life insurance policy. In fact, I encourage a lot of times for advisors, don't put that on your illustration because you're going to confuse the client unless you spend a lot of time explaining to the client and why. Because you're going to see negative annual rates of return up front. And then as policy goes on in time, you're going to see higher returns than what the IRR is showing. And the reason for that is, again, the IRR is looking for a number that solves for every year being the same. So if we have low numbers, negative returns on the front, then the policy annually has to earn higher than that IRR number on the back end so that it has the equivalent of earning a certain number all the way through. And that's a hard thing for people to get their head around, because what they see is, when they look at an IRR, well, the IRR in the first year is minus 50%, but the IRR in the, say, seventh year is 1%. Well, I had 8 years before I ever get positive. Well, but when you get positive, you got positive for every single year prior to that, too. It's the equivalent of earning that the whole time frame. And so that's what we have to keep in our mind as far as IRR goes. And so it's an important piece to see. When we look at IRR and the true IRR on a life insurance policy, and think about it from the insurance company standpoint, and you know, we're talking about mutual life insurance companies, right? Where the basically the policy owners are owners of the company as well in some portion, and they deserve a dividend from the profits of that insurance company. If the insurance company is charging less on money that you're taking out of there than they're paying you, then the insurance company is not going to stay in business. You can, you know, have, well, they do it in volume. No, that still won't work, right? So they have to earn more than what they're paying out. And so when we look at it from the standpoint of a loan, and I think this is where people forget, because they look at it as it's their own money they're borrowing, but they're not. Their life insurance policy is just collateral. And so it's put up as collateral, which is why the life insurance policy cash value still gets a dividend. It still gets paid a dividend because you didn't take it out. You borrowed money from the insurance company. Well, when you borrow money from the insurance company, they had to take it out of the pool of money that they're doing their investments with. And that would impact all of the other policyholders if they had less money in there to earn dividends. So what does the insurance company do? They charge interest, which needs to be at least whatever they're earning in their portfolio. And that's got to be more, or the earnings, the charge, sorry, on the loan has to be more than what they're crediting you in dividends. It's the only way that will work overall. And that's what they're doing. So the idea of arbitrage, it really, there might be certain time frames when that happens, but I think it's the separation, and people are trying to look at comparing their cash growth to their loan growth. And I would encourage people to separate those two out completely. And what I mean by that is, we've got a safe liquid asset in the form of life insurance cash value, right? We can ask, it's got reserves behind it. It's got all these pieces. So it's a safe liquid asset, which really applies to savings vehicles. It's not an investment from that standpoint. Yep. It's really a savings vehicle that we could use to buy an investment, as you know, our earlier examples. But when we look at it from that standpoint, that's where the comparison needs to make. What is the growth in here compared to other like assets? Checking account, money market, CDs, those kind of things, right? And so it's certainly better than that. And we don't have to pay tax on it annually. And there's no management fee on that piece. That number that we get from the insurance company, from the IRR, is net of all of that stuff, right? And so we're looking at a pretty substantial number, even at that point in time. When we look at the loan shouldn't be compared to what we're earning any more than a loan we have at the bank. We compare that against our savings account, right? It's compared to other options to get money. That's what we need to be comparing it about against, not against the cash that's in there. Those are two separate issues.
Beautifully said. I mean, you took a impossible question with like 10 questions in it, and really appreciate how your brain works. I want to use an example. And this is an example of an illustration that I ran for, you know, a 36-year-old. And so this is just for illustration purposes only. I'm not saying that every company is a little bit different, but it had an internal rate of return at the end of 30 years at 4.5.
Okay.
Which is a great internal rate of return, especially over a year ago. You know, as interest rates rise, we might see things, this might be more common, it might not be. The point is, what you're saying is that's like it's earning 4.5% every single year, even including the beginning years where you, if you look on an illustration, it looks red. It's not that it's finally earning. It's assuming that you're earning that every single year. That's correct?
That's correct. So how can it do that? That means in that 30th year, it's earning way more than 4.5%, so that it's the equivalent of 4.5% every year, even those negative years.
Right. So then, so right there, if we just compare it to like assets, and again, this was ran over a year ago. And so what other savings accounts, high yield savings accounts, they wouldn't be over 30 years, even if we compared today and we actually said, what does the next 30 years look like? Whole life insurance, when set up and used properly, will trounce those rates of return. I think everyone would agree there. But the reality is, we're not even comparing apples to apples, because if you're comparing it to a high yield savings account, there's certain things that you have to pay, like i.e. taxes. So the high yield savings account, what would the high yield savings account have to earn if you had to pay taxes? And this, I'm getting this exactly from you. I think the and asset came exactly from you, because you've talked about this as an and, as an and, as an and. But using your math at 30% at a 4.5% internal rate of return, now you're looking at something over 6.4% that you have to make every single year just to keep up with the boring old life insurance. And it's because in the life insurance policy, it's already factoring in that it's a tax-free rate of return, whereas in a different asset, you have to factor in taxes. Anything that, did I butcher that? How do we say that?
No, that was good. I would adjust your language a little bit. It's a tax-deferred asset. The way it's really classified, life insurance is tax-deferred, but it becomes tax-free if we die with it at the end, and it pays into our heirs. So we have some tax strategy around it, but it is considered really tax deferred as far as the asset, but we're not paying tax on it annually. So yes, you're right on track. And that's where that comparison needs to be, is when we look at all those pieces, but there's another piece there, right? Do we get other things with the life insurance policy?
Yes.
Like a death benefit, right?
Yep.
Then yep. If we went the savings account route, we'd have to buy term insurance to protect our family. So now then that's an additional cost that if we saw what happened, if we took term premiums out of that other asset, now then you're pushing up the return to, who knows, 7+ on what you'd have to earn just to keep up with the life insurance, not to beat it, but just to keep up with it.
You go.
I was just going to say, and then what a lot of people say is, well, okay, so I can't do that with the savings account, but I can do that in the market. But understand, if now we shift to the market, now you got to add management fees in there. So if you're adding 2 points to a management fee, now you're having to earn, you know, somewhere around 9% every single year just to keep up, and you're going to lose the death benefit because that term insurance is going to run out versus the whole life being in place your whole life. And so, you know, that keeps going in that direction. But is there something else you want to say on that subject before
for this example, and again, this is just for an example, sure, educational purpose only, a 4.5% internal rate of return when you factor in a 30% tax, a 1% fee, and then I just looked at the cost of insurance that the person would have to pay in term over those 30 years.
Right.
And we're looking at a 10.69% every single year. And so the point that I'm trying to make and you're making is, we're not saying that life insurance, whole life insurance, earns almost 11%. That would be incorrect and would be misleading if I said that. But what I am saying is, if we actually compare this apples to apples to a like asset, this is a more accurate number just when we're comparing the rate of return to other like assets.
Right. It's not that the life insurance is earning that, but what you are saying is you would have to earn that in a like asset to compete, to keep up with it, right?
That's correct.
And so here's what's interesting about that. 10.69, is that what you said was the number? Okay. So at 10.69, some people would even say at that 10.69, well, the S&P is average 12, so let's forget about the safe liquid aspect of it. I'm going to hold it for the long term, so the ups and downs are going to hurt me. I can do 12% every year, so that beats the 10.69. this is the part that's left out of that conversation. What people remember is, A, the S&P, the best of the best. And if we look at like Dow Bar, we see that that's not what really people are doing, but everybody wants to talk about it. But there's another component that's even more detrimental to that account, is, and that is that people carry bonds to balance that fund for the ups and downs on the equity side, but they don't put that into the equation. And so, you know, looking at a 12, just rough numbers, if we thought we could do 12% in the S&P all the way through, and we were doing a 50-50 split between bonds and at 4% and that 12%, then what we're doing is somewhere around 8% overall. So that weight of those bonds that we have to support the equity side actually makes 12% turn into 8%. And the life insurance policy is outrunning that. And we're not saying that life insurance should be compared to investments. It shouldn't. It's a savings vehicle, right? But it is interesting how closely the return relates to even, you know, what people expect to do elsewhere.
I think that's well said. And another way to say this is, you can utilize your policy to put money in the market if you have so much confidence in the S&P. And if that's the thing that you decide that you want to put your money into, there's a world where you could put money into life insurance and get all the benefits that life insurance gives you and have the right to be able to go and have that money compound. And as long as you're earning more than what you're paying the insurance company for the right to borrow their money, you technically on paper are ahead. Any thoughts on that? Or would you caution people to do that? Or what do you see the pros and cons of doing something, you know, like that?
I think there are some pieces out there. So Garrett Gunderson, one of his talks is about investor DNA. And I think that's an important piece. You know, what we're talking about is the pure math in this, but if investing in the market isn't part of who you are, it's not a good idea any more than real estate or anything else. It needs to be something that's part of your DNA to make those decisions. But I think that's a critical point, is think about those two examples. If we have the life insurance that's doing that great rate of return, we can still put money in the market or real estate or somewhere else because we have access to that cash. If instead we start with an or asset, the real estate or mutual funds or whatever else, that's one dimensional on those other assets. So how do we get to those funds? You know, we don't know what the market's going to be. You could argue, well, we could liquidate that and go buy something else. But what if it's in a time during that average the market's down? Well, you certainly wouldn't want to do it then. And so by doing it the other way around, not only do we get that great return over time, but we're in that and position of taking advantage of opportunities that come along or get us through emergencies that come along. And the emergency side's important, you know, going back to a black swan idea. How many people made money when we saw the crashes in 08 and 09? The people that were holding on to cash? Yeah. And we're able to buy in those time frames, they made out like bandits. You hear about all the destruction that happened. There were a lot of people hung out to dry. Why? Because they didn't have that and asset. They didn't have that wild card out there to get them through that time.
Yeah. I think our friend Gary Gunderson said it well. Money didn't vanish. It transferred.
You're right.
You know, it's like it really gets you started thinking about, you know, 2008 was a horrible time for not everybody. Some people look back on those times and are very fond. And it's R. Nelson Nash talks about this concept of the golden rule. I think it's well said. It's those who have the gold make the rules. Wow. And I think another way to say it. Do you have time for one more question, or do we need to wrap this up?
I'm good.
So last thing, I want to have you back on, you and Kim on, and we can talk about distribution. I think there's some really cool things that you're working on and really being able to articulate the future. I know you guys don't like the word retirement. I use it because that's the thing that most people think of. But like in the future cash flow planning, whatnot, I would love to have you on and us do like a boring old case study, but I know our audience will eat that up with the math. So that's an invite. Would love to make that happen. But what I want to ask you is around index universal life and whole life. And there's a big debate going on in the world, and lots of people that have very passionate views on either side. And I think you have a very definite, unemotional point that it can be made when it comes to should you use whole life or index universal life and the pros and cons. And I would love to just have you share your perspective. You're not a spring chicken. This is not your first year in the industry. You've seen a lot, and like you've seen cycles. And we're also not selling life insurance as a sexy investment. So I think when people that hear our message, they're already understand, and it's not a big deal. But like, there's still like, for people that don't understand this concept of a safe and asset and all the things that we talked about, there's this shiny factor that index universal life is, and there's a lot of people that are flocking to it to sell it and they would say invest in it. And I just want to hear from you why that could be damaging. And if we took a step back, why are you all in on whole life and so adamantly against index universal life as it relates to permanent life insurance?
Okay, great question. So here's the big picture. There's lots of pieces to it, but I think the main thing is, so Norman Baker, my mentor, told me something 30 plus years ago that I always remember, and that is there are no deals in the insurance industry. And what he meant by that was everything is a trade-off between cost and risk for the insurance company. And let's take that in an extreme. Why is term insurance so, quote, cheap? It's not really cheap because we hope to not collect on it, so it's all cost. But the premiums are very inexpensive compared to whole life premiums at the other extreme, right? Why? Because of the risk for the insurance company. When the insurance company has somebody go through underwriting and they know their health and they give them a term insurance policy, it's very unlikely that the insurance company has any risk of that person dying in the time frame that they have the term insurance. Whole life, on the other extreme, the insurance company is on the risk all the way out for their whole life. The premium is higher, okay? And so those are those extremes. Now we take universal life, and it doesn't matter if it's indexed, it doesn't matter if it's interest sensitive or variable in the marketplace. It's a different product that people have said, and I quote, it's whole life for half the price. Well, it can't be that, because the only way the insurance company can charge less for it is if they have released some risk in some form along the way. And typically that's going to be in the form of the policy will lapse before somebody can use it or before somebody dies or those kind of things. And so it's not the index that's the problem. And the index is the sexy part. People say, oh, I get to invest in the market. But if that's really what I want to do, I could buy a whole life policy, borrow against it, and play in the marketplace. And that, to me, would be safer than using an indexed universal life policy. And the second piece is when we look at just the index side, people say, well, I get to experience only the upsides of the markets and none of the downsides because it's got a zero floor, say, in the particular policy they're looking at. But that zero floor comes at a cost. And the cost is a cap on how high it can go. So even though the market may do 12, 15, 20%, that cap on the other end might be that the insurance company only credits 7, 8% on the top end. So while they cap the floor, they also cap the top. And what's interesting in running some numbers and just looking at the pure growth, like in the S&P with those caps and floors, the variable policy would actually outperform. Even though it had the negatives, it was able to take advantage of the upsides. It would outperform inside of those caps. Well, the variable policies saw trouble staying in force all the way out. And if they did, and now we've potentially got a reduced amount, I don't see how the indexed ones can make it out there to the time frame. And so now somebody may put money in there all along the way and find out it's not going to get them there. And there's a couple of issues that are there with that. It's the lack of guarantee on that end. And if we go back to the beginning of our conversation and we talk about certainty and what it allows us to do, it allows us to unlock uncertainty assets without taking on a a huge amount of risk because we have that. If we don't know for sure that that life insurance policy, that potential wild card, if we don't know for sure it's going to be in place to cover those other things, then how can we leverage that? How can we take advantage of that? Because what if that universal life policy isn't there to lean on? With my whole life policy, the fact that I know it's going to happen, and I like to use an analogy. If you knew in the future you were going to win the lottery, would it change how you spent money today?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. With my whole life policy, I know what it's going to do in the future. It's guaranteed to happen. And if I outlive it, then I get it. So if I live past 120, I get the death benefit even though I'm still alive. It's going to happen. Well, if I know that, I can use actuarial advantage, leverage, and leverage that against what I'm doing today, against other assets and other things. I really can't do that with a universal life policy safely. And there's arguments that, well, if you watch it really close and you see what it's doing and make sure everything's timed just right, and when it gets a little off base, add some more money. Okay, do you really want that kind of stress in your life with what's supposed to be the certainty asset? That's the whole point, is taking stress away, right?
Yeah, I think if we, that was beautiful, and I appreciate you articulating the way that you articulate. I think if you're looking at index universal life as an investment alternative, that's like, there's not certainty when you invest. It's not 100% certain. There's a chance of loss, and technically that chance of loss could be lose everything. I think so. I'm with you. It's like, if you want to go play that route, great. I think the math would say, and this is where I would agree with all the TikTokers on the other side that all hate life insurance, it's like, don't mix your investments and insurance together because you're not going to get a great result. I actually agree with them. I think there's a lot of truth to that. But if you want to do the index universal life as like your investment, and you've done your research and that's great, awesome. But the big problem that I've heard you articulate, and it really makes sense to me, is if we call this permanent insurance, which is not an investment and should last our entire life, and now you create something that looks more like an investment than a permanent, safe, certain asset, you give everyone a bad rap when you're 80 years old, and now you're at risk of losing everything in this permanent insurance policy, which majority of people are like, how is permanent life insurance not fulfilling on their promises? It gives everybody a bad rap. Whereas in reality, they hijacked the benefits of permanent life insurance and tried to soup it up to be something that would get more people to invest or pour money into it. And so I don't know, like, I just appreciate the way that you articulate things, because for everything that you laid out, that's why would you want to create a foundation of something that maybe has a little bit more upside, but also could freaking collapse? You can't build a foundation. You can't build a building on a 50-50 foundation. Like, we wouldn't want to stay there.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You know, I asked a question, and I asked the wrong question at your last event last summer, right? And my question was, what does permanent mean to you? And it was with somebody who was supporting the universal life side. And they gave me the technical answer, which was correct. And that is, the reason it's classified as permanent is because it's guaranteed renewal as long as you have enough premium to put into it, right? So as long as you can pay the premium, then you don't have to reapply for it. You don't have to go through underwriting. Term insurance, on the other hand, like 30-year term insurance, you'd have to go through underwriting again to reinstate it, right? So that's why they call it permanent. My question should have been, what does the public think permanent means? And what public thinks permanent means is it's going to be there forever. And that cannot be said for universal life. And that's where the problem is. And you probably, because of your age, haven't been on phone calls. We've had people, because of just being out in the marketplace, some people say, oh, we'll call them and see. This just couldn't be true. Somebody, literally, we've had several of these, maybe husband and wife, husband's in the hospital. The wife is calling on the phone, literally saying, my husband is in the hospital. We do not know if he's going to get out or not. I just got a notice from the insurance company, and they're telling me this universal life policy is going to lapse tomorrow. It's supposed to be permanent. Can they really do that? Even... we didn't sell it, and we have to deliver the bad news and say, I'm really sorry. I know that what your agent probably implied was that it was guaranteed to be there from now on, and the truth is, it's not if you live too long. That's tough.
Yeah.
Somebody's put money in there, and you think about the long term. They did without a cabin in the woods with the family. They did all these things to be responsible and ensure that they weren't going to be a burden and other things, and now they find out it's not going to pay out in the end. That's tough. I don't want to be able to do that.
If you're going
to
use some of the talking points that we use, especially as a foundational asset, make sure that it's actually a solid foundation and not a speculative hope asset. Thank you so much for listening to the Better Wealth Podcast. It would mean the world to me if you could hit subscribe, leave a review, and share this with the people that you know and love.